This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the first show for 2021. January 4th, 2021, first show. I can't even tell you. Andrew, how long have we been doing this? Andrew says, too long. He didn't have enough fingers. Anyway, joining us today, I mean, this is really a rock star coming out of the gates on the first show, January 4th, Joe Sullender. Joe is the Managing Director, Investments, Sullender Utley Group of Wells Fargo Advisors. Wells Fargo Clearing Services, LLC, member SIPC. Good morning, Joe. I'm out of wind.
Yeah, that was quite an introduction. Good morning. long job title these days.
Long job title to be coordinated with the long time we've been working together. I was asking you before, I can't remember whether it was 20 years, 25 years.
It's at least 20. It might be 25. But I was what, 12 when we met? Let's go with that.
Yeah, and I was 13. Okay, Joe. So if we're looking at financial planning, how about this? If I hit the ball back to you, we got some email questions in, so maybe this is a way to start with it. Does your guest agree that a retirement plan would not be complete without a long-term care plan? And we'll talk about long-term care later, but I think the message that this gentleman, he's very good with the questions, a retirement plan has to come with financial planning as well. So what do you find when you talk to the groups that maybe you would, it would be harsh to say you're surprised at the question that you think sometimes, gee, I thought, that was covered throughout one's career. And especially dealing with finance, people don't always understand finance and they don't ever understand tax. And you and I usually are coupled around the same day. So after somebody does benefits, you and I do the other part.
Yep. Well, normally when your first focus is retirement planning in the seminars, and frankly with most people that you work with, is the retirement and investment planning around it. And then of course you're gonna get the what ifs, what happens if, what if my spouse passes away before we retire? What if I have health problems? And of course, long-term care is one of those big questions that everything looks just fine as long as, I'm healthy and I can pay for my bills and my retirement. What happens if I go into long-term care? So the question about having a plan, I think, is absolutely true. You should have long-term care plans as part of your calculations. Now, that may very well be that you've got enough income coming in retirement that if you go into long-term care, you can continue to cover it. One thing I've seen a lot, just now that I have a lot of aging clients who are in that phase of life, is they were spending X amount of dollars a month on travel and fun retirement things. And now that expense just simply goes and pays for their long-term care. And a lot of times that matches up and they can cover it. But the question really is whether you should have insurance to back it up. And I think that's a valid one to explore. Certainly not, before maybe 60 or late 50s, but certainly as you near retirement to think about how you would pay for long-term care if you needed it.
Do you find that there is an initial, I don't see the need to do this. And then after you talk, not that you're trying to sell the person on the idea, but you just quote, stats, and it doesn't take long to figure out maybe I do have a need. And I'd also imagine long-term care policies would cover different distribution maximum. So somebody that had this great history, parental history, they're having insurance for exactly what the term means, insurance, that they won't be caught short.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest challenges too is if you go look for long-term care insurance now is how much the industry has changed over the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you bought a policy, you paid the same premiums your whole life, and you got a definite, you got a benefit out of it if you needed it. About, you know, it was a little bit, it was 8, 9 years ago, all the policies started raising their premiums on existing policyholders because the combination of low interest rates, of rising healthcare costs, and insurance companies just found themselves holding the bag. So they started raising the premiums. So now when you buy a policy, there's no guarantee that the premiums stay the same. In fact, you can pretty much guarantee that they probably will go up at some point. So it's created two things. One, it's made it a lot more challenging to figure out whether insurance is the right move for your long-term care needs. And secondly, it's a whole new industry now of all these hybrid products and things that are that are combinations of life insurance and long-term care insurance. It gets quite complicated and it's evolving every day.
So how does one get tutelage on this? Is there a book to read? Is there, of course, they should listen to the For Your Benefit radio show, but we don't, you know, we don't cover long-term care on every show. When you address groups, some of your groups are large and some of them are not so large. But when you get there, you're tying together the benefit planning, financial planning, to some degree tax planning, and the discussion of all the above would be lacking if it didn't cover long-term care. Now, you don't sell long-term care insurance, but you're trying to make the class realize they probably have a need for it, or if they don't have a need for it.
Yeah, and probably the best thing to do there, if you're not in a seminar or, you know, some sort of setting like that, is if anyone has a financial planner, somebody that they're working with, you know, to help them with their retirement planning or their investments or so forth, this is part of the big picture, and that's a question that they should ask and get some guidance there. And most planners do sell long-term care insurance as well, so they can provide you with policies. But for Fed employees, I think the important thing is then, if you have that planner to show you, here's what I recommend, to compare it to the federal long-term care program and get literature for both. And I found that to be as good of an education as any. It's just having both of them in front of you and kind of walking through the pros and the cons of each plan and deciding which one's right for you or whether you want to buy it at all.
Okay. And one of the bullet points we agreed to talk about, and this would encompass financial as well as long-term care risk management. When some people hear risk, it sounds like risky, but there's a risk to, I won't say everything, but a good percentage, but certainly setting goals. When our, you know, the group we talk to, for the most part, they've got an annuity. Not for the most part, it's probably about 99.9% have an annuity, a monthly payment for life based on years in service and highest compensation. And then they would turn to a question, well, if I look to take Social Security sooner rather than later, there's a risk to it. It's not a risk management, but there's a risk that maybe you took it too early and others might be too late. But more importantly, risk management, I think, is associated with financial planning.
And or investments, really, the risk of your investments, your TSP and your other investments.
So when you talk to a group, I would say that, and with all due respects, we talk to a group that's fairly cautious, the federal employee. Mm-hmm. They may not be educated on financial planning. They may not be on tax, and they may not be on legal. But you have to address, and you can feel the class out more often than not. And depending on what agency you might be going to, they might be more analytical than others. But all of them probably say, I didn't know that, after you get about 5 minutes into your presentation. So what do you find that surprises you, in all due respects to the people, it just surprises you that maybe with all the information with regards to investing into the thrift and the like, they still go, that's that risky fund for stocks. I want the government
risk
fund.
Risk is a horribly misunderstood word when it comes to investments and financials, you know, retirement planning and so forth, is because, you know, risk could mean, some people think, you hear the word risk and they think the risk of losing all of their money, you know, and that certainly is risk. But really what risk is volatility. You know, I think this year has, or 2000, sorry, last year, we can happily say now, 2020 was a good example of what volatility looks like. I mean, the market was up significantly last year, but we had a couple months where we were down 15-20%, you know, just like that. And then everything recovered. So the volatility of those numbers, of that performance, the experience of your investments is really what risk is. And I would evaluate it on two levels. And I think a lot of people miss this. Is number one is the risk of, well, how much risk do you need to take to meet your goals? Because obviously the higher return potential you have in your investments, the higher risk. So if you need 8-10% to meet your goals, you're going to have to take more risk than somebody who needs 4-5%, meaning more volatility, more unpredictability. Once you have that number, then the second way to evaluate risk is your emotional stomach, for lack of a better word, for the risk. Is, I mean, I could sit down, Bob, and tell you that, you know, you can afford to retire and meet your goals if we get an 8-9% rate of return and feel very comfortable that we can achieve that. But if the market then your accounts drop 20-30% and you're calling me in a panic, then we've breached your risk tolerance and the plan isn't going to work for the long haul. So I think that second one is the tricky part. And years like 2020 hopefully help people, I don't want to say test their risk tolerance, but sort of evaluate how much of it they can handle at their different stages of life.
So during the time that you've been doing it, you've probably met I won't say a significant percent, but a percentage of the people that just don't want to be associated with risk. So they would like to keep their money in one of the funds, the G fund. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, fund for all seasons, and eventually is going to come out fine. But in the career, what percentage would you say of the people that come in to meet you for the first time are of that mindset? I don't want any risk.
I'd say it's probably a quarter, to be fair. And that's just sort of anecdotal off the top of my head. It's not as large as you might think. And it could be that I have a biased group, because people that are coming to sit down with a planner are maybe more looking for more growth. I mean, if you're 100% G fund, there's not a lot to talk about what we do with your TSP. It is what it is. It earns a fixed interest rate and so forth. So so I would say it's a fairly small amount, except for the one thing that always scares me is what I do see a lot is people who are 100% G because they just moved it to the G. In other words, they were watching the news or getting scared about the market and they pulled everything out. That one always scares me, because that means they timed the market. They made a prediction, you know, to try to get out at a high, which, you know, again, that could be very costly as you get close to retirement if you do that wrong.
Okay. Andrew says this is a perfect time for a break. So we'll take a break and let the listeners know what WEPA, the sponsor of the show, can do for them.
Federal Open season is over, but there's never been a better time to reevaluate your life insurance coverage. Get life insurance for less with WEPA. WEPA has been insuring the future of federal employees for more than 75 years. WEPA can be used as a supplement or replacement for your existing policy and can cost less than Fegley. In fact, last year, members who switched saved $375 on average. Although open season is over, you can apply anytime for WEPA Group Term Life Insurance. See how much you can save by visiting WEPA.org today.
Okay, welcome back to the January 4th, first show of the year, 2021, and Joe Sullender. And we've been working together for a long time, and Joe is a certified financial planner, and his title is Joe Sullender, Managing Director, Investments, Sullender Utley Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, Wells Fargo Clearing Services, LLC, member SIPC. Whew. All righty,
yeah,
Joe.
You only have to do that once, Bob. You don't have to.
Oh, I don't have to do that each time?
No, just once is fine.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Joe.
What am I going to do with the rest of the time?
All right.
Yeah, exactly. Give us more time. Let me expand one thing before the break. We were talking about risk, and I think it's pertinent for the first show of the year. Is because 2020 was such an unusual year and certainly volatile in the markets, I always think when you get to the beginning of the year and you're trying to figure out what you should be evaluating, what New Year's resolutions you might have, one of them that I hope people take the time to do is not only evaluate their plans as far as can I afford to retire, am I on track yet, all those sorts of things, but also evaluate the risk in your investments. You know, and you can even take a look at how did they perform in 2020 as a way to kind of look at it. That's one thing that CFPs, you know, financial planners do when they sit down and meet with folks is help them try to analyze and evaluate that risk, which I think is, I say it in the seminars, I think it's the most overlooked step of the process and the least understood is how much, very few people, you know, you ask them, what's your TSP worth? They know. Or how's your TSP allocated? They know. But what they don't always know is how much risk they're taking or are able to articulate that. So I think that's just kind of an important thing to do, especially when you're nearing retirement or going into an uncertain period of time.
So when you speak to clients like that, there is a, quote, time value of money. Probably the majority of the new clients you're speaking with would be covered under FERS, probably still some CSRS. But FERS, it's a balancing act. Certainly, they get this guaranteed annuity for life, but that's not necessarily going to pay all the bills years out. And then there's an issue, when do you claim Social Security or not? And then distributions from the thrift. And do people fully understand what you would lay out for them to say, okay, you've got this here, you've got this in the thrift, and you've got this annuity, and here's maybe the way we should look at it with regards to before we go into the first one of the choices? I mean, clearly they're going to take the annuity, but the annuity, generally speaking, isn't going to necessarily take care of all their expenses.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first step, is you kind of to walk through it step by step. The first step is, what do you anticipate your expenses will look like in retirement, and how close will you be to meeting them out of the annuity on a net basis? And I think, you know, there are people that can pay all their expenses from their annuity, but like you said, there's a lot of them that cannot. So what do you do with those folks? The way I look at it is, if you need $6,000, let's say, a month to live your life, and four of it is coming from the annuity, then we need to do a retirement plan to figure out where we're going to get that additional $2,000. And there's sort of a couple questions about that. One is, can we afford to get that additional $2,000? Do we have enough money saved? I mean, have we accumulated enough to make that work? Secondly, how aggressive or conservative do we have to be in our growth of our investments to make that work? But then thirdly, which I know one of the questions was about, which we can go into more detail on, is, okay, now I know it works. I know I've got my money invested correctly. What account do I take that $2,000 a month from? So, you know, we can go into that if you like.
Well, let's do it. Let me read it. I'm a retired federal employee, age 58. Folks, these email questions really do come from people. Joe and I don't make up the questions. So anyway, I'm a retired federal employee, age 58, single, and I have a seven-figure TSP. I don't know whether to withdraw from my bonds, which are in the TSP, my Roth IRA. And so the question here is, from an efficient tax viewpoint, what would you say to the person? Now, of course, you don't know the person, but we got a good idea. They've got an annuity. Maybe it could have been larger if they worked to 65, but they said, no, I've saved. I'm 58. I feel comfortable, but I don't know which one to draw from first.
It's all about, like he asked, tax efficiency is, you know, which assets are going to cost you the most to withdraw. The cheapest assets would be a Roth IRA, because those assets grow tax-free and you can withdraw them tax-free. However, I don't put them at the front of the line because they grow tax-free. You know, I could take 10 grand out of my Roth IRA and not pay any taxes, but I'd kind of rather let that money stay in the Roth, where it's continuing to grow in a tax-sheltered way for future withdrawals. So I wouldn't do the Roth first. Where I would start is sort of the pecking order. First would be your savings. If you have, I mean, that part always kills me. Somebody retires, they have 100 grand in savings, and they need 2,000 a month, and they start withdrawing from their TSP. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because your TSP is taxable. Everything you withdraw is taxed as ordinary income. So I would much rather you spend your savings. You can take 2 grand out of savings and it costs you nothing. There's no risk, there's no fees, there's no taxes. It's the freest money there is for you to spend. So it would be savings first, and then it would be what I would call taxable investments, brokerage accounts, bonds like this guy mentioned, CDs, individual stocks. Those you would only pay capital gains taxes on whatever. If you sell a stock and use the money from that, or a mutual fund, you would pay just a lower tax rate, but on only on the gains. So the moral of this story is I would spend all of my outside money before I made any withdrawals from the TSP. And I think that's one mistake a lot of people make, is they think, well, I've saved in this TSP my whole career. I got $1 million, like this guy said, and I'm retired. I want to use it. I want to spend it. But if you have other money, I would certainly use that first, because any withdrawal from the TSP will be taxed at ordinary income.
Okay. So if we looked at it that way, there will be a time when we have to flick the switch from one and take it out of the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, eventually they make us take it out.
That's true.
But if you were talking to them, some of them are going to go, no, you know, this is sacred. I don't want to take anything out of that. And that's the one you really want them to take it out of. Mm-hmm. What discussions have you had there where the person had an idea what they wanted to do, and they wanted to come in, of course, talk to you to get the professional viewpoint and to maybe say, maybe you shouldn't take that approach?
Well, if they're going to come in and get a professional viewpoint, and then I've certainly had this, and go, I appreciate that advice. Now I'm going to go do whatever it is I wanted to do in the first place. There's not a whole lot you can do about that. You know, it's just a matter, like you mentioned, they do force you to take money out of the TSP when you're 72, a relatively small amount. I just generally don't advise people taking money out of the TSP when they have other funds just for the tax purposes. I mean, it can have a domino effect. It can raise your tax bracket. It can affect your Medicare premiums. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can come into play when you start making those withdrawals. But in general, if the question is, what do you do when clients don't take your advice? The answer is sort of, you just let them go, I guess. Let them do what they want to do.
Well, yeah, that without question. Then, with regards to Roth limitations, so if mm-hmm. you make more than X, or there's a single dollar amount and there's a joint dollar amount. Now, what I'm mm-hmm. talking about here are Roth conversions. So somebody would take money out of maybe a Roth IRA and put it out of a traditional IRA, and they would be reluctant to pay the tax, because when it goes into a Roth IRA, then you pay the taxes up front. There was a TSP administrator years ago, and he had a great sense of humor, and he goes, well, picture yourself walking into a restaurant. Do you pay me now or do you pay me later? So, and I thought it was a great analogy with the Roth money. You know, do I pay the taxes now and don't pay taxes later, or do I get a tax deduction? People, you know, many people just really like that idea of a tax deduction, and the idea that they wouldn't get one doesn't resonate right away until you impress upon them, look what your money's going to be doing in the medium term and long term.
Yeah, this is even worse, because they're not only not getting it, they're not getting a tax deduction. They're actually voluntarily raising their taxes. You know, if I were to convert $50,000 from my IRA to a Roth IRA, I'm adding 50 grand to my taxable income voluntarily. And, you know, people don't really like to do that. I mean, one way that I sort of present it, if you think about it, is if you could look at your IRA right now and go back to what it was worth 5 years ago, and have converted it even 5 years ago and paid the taxes on it then, would that have been a good deal? I mean, if that IRA was $50,000 then and now it's 80, and now that 80,000 is tax-free from the rest of your life, and that's only over maybe 3 to 5 years, then, you know, it certainly is economical to do. It's something that I think a lot of people are averse to, just for the very reason you said, because you're voluntarily raising your taxes. But it's like you said, it's taking the bullet now so that down the road you have the flexibility of a completely tax-free account.
That's a good comment. And again, I don't do financial planning, but for some reason people think I do. And because, you know, I deal with taxes and a little bit of economics in there. But mm-hmm. the point that some of the folks more recently have been saying, the market's just been terrific. I'm getting fear of heights here, and I want to pull some money off the table. And I, of course, don't give them any advice. The advice would be talk to your financial planner. And mm-hmm. do you get many calls like that? We really did good, Joe.
Yeah.
Is it time to exit?
And there's a great way to answer that, too, is when you feel that urge. And I love when people ask that question because they're thinking about it the right way, is when the market is high, should I be pulling money off the table? When the market is low, should I be adding money, as opposed to the opposite? And people, most of the folks that I work with have that ideology pretty well intact. But the way that I would answer that question is people hear that and they think the market is high. Should I make an adjustment and get more conservative? That's a little bit of timing the market. You're saying the market is high. Well, it could be higher tomorrow. It could be higher next year. We don't know where these peaks and valleys actually will fall. So, but when the market has had such a run like it has, at least in the last 6 months, what I tend to tell people to do is, what a great time to reevaluate your entire plan. Because if you now have more money than you had 6 months ago, the calculations for you meeting your retirement goals and any other goal that you might have are going to look better. So we might take a new snapshot of all of that and find that you can reduce your overall risk in your plan by getting more conservative and having more predictability going forward. So I do think when the markets are high are great times to be able to have those conversations. Not so much that we're using a crystal ball to time the market, but that we're taking advantage of market upswings.
All righty. Now, let's take a look at you talking with somebody that went to one of your seminar presentations, and they've really not done any investment outside of putting money into the TSP and or CDs and the like. And so they're very anxious to associate any of that investment with, quote, risk, end of quote. Risk, again, is not risky. But how do you get them to put their toe in the water or foot in the water and say, okay, let's give this a try for whatever the period of time might be? And then they go, well, that wasn't so bad. I'll put my other foot in.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair way to put it. And part of any planner's job is to help the client be able to analyze their risk tolerance and get a feel for their experience. If they've never invested in anything outside of the TSP, it would be completely imprudent to just throw them into something super aggressive that they would have no way of knowing if it was too aggressive for them. So that's one of the key roles of a planner, and why I tend to, you know, obviously it's what I am and what I do is to push folks away more to that and away from people just selling investments, because, you know, that has nothing to do with your own personal risk tolerance. One other thing I'd add to that, Bob, too, is one of the key things to do to manage risk, not only going up and down the scale for what you need to meet your goals or how much growth you're looking for, is also with diversification. And I think that's one of the easier ways for people to reduce their overall risk, is make sure that they're not, you know, 100% in an S&P index fund, that they've got a variety of investments that complement each other to get more consistent returns. I think that's really, really key as people get 10 years or less away from retirement, is making sure that there's a deeper diversification and balance to what they're investing in.
Okay, so there's another question that came in, actually from the same person. They asked very good questions, and here we go. I'm retired and contemplating applying for Social Security benefits at my age 62. I have read many articles that the trust funds for Medicare and Social Security have depleted due to the pandemic, and I'm anxious about the future. So how do we respond to that?
Well, on a sort of the view from 1,000 feet, as they say, is Tammy and I, Tammy Flanagan, who I'm sure listeners have heard on here and are aware of, she and I believe, even did a radio show a few years ago with you, where we really kind of debated whether someone should take Social Security early or wait until full retirement age or delay it. And she's even written some great articles on the topic as well. People can Google and find. There's not a right or wrong answer to this, I don't believe. I think there's a good argument for taking Social Security earlier. There's a good argument for delaying it until later. I don't know that I would base my decision on things like this question is asking, you know, on sort of doom and gloom predictions, if you will. I do think obviously it's a concern, but if you are 60, 61, 62, I mean, do we really think that your Social Security benefits are going to be impacted by this? Or is it something that's probably going to have more of an effect on younger people? Maybe they'll push the retirement date back. Maybe they'll change the COLAs. Maybe they'll, you know, reduce the benefit for people under a certain age. But for people right on the verge of retirement who are faced with this decision, and this person, I think, was, you know, was there at that point, retired and contemplating applying for it at 62. I don't know that I think I would deal with what's right in my face there and make the call. Do I need the income? If I don't, then I could choose to defer it. And, you know, life expectancy, other questions that come into play to make the best decision for you.
All righty. Years ago, with one of the speakers, not Tammy, but one of the benefit speakers, and I had a nice discussion. We're the same age, and in this case, it was a he, decided to take Social Security as early as possible. Now, me being a bean counter, I say, no, I'm going to wait till 70 and a half when they make me take it. And what he said, and I go, it's got a point. He said, I don't necessarily need, because I'm still working full time and the like, I don't need the money so it can sit there and grow, such that at 70 and a half, when I then access the money, I can use the money that I set aside starting at a very young age, relatively speaking, and I could take out of that pot and I would equal the income in total that I was receiving. If I didn't live a long time, there's a chunk of money someplace that would go to my heirs. If I become a descendant of Methuselah, but maybe I could question it, but at that point, you can't change things. So it was an interesting discussion.
Well, yeah. Even in what you just said, think how many variables you just mentioned there. I mean, that's the trick with all this planning is, how long are you going to live? You know, how much income do you need? What if you don't take Social Security? What is that pot of money that you're taking the money from earning? You know, what are the tax implications of withdrawing from that pot of money? I mean, there's an awful lot of variables to make that decision. So I know a lot of times with seminars and radio shows and things like that, people are looking for a stock answer. But I think this is one of those things that there's some good spirited points of view on both sides.
Yeah, there is no good answer because there's emotion that's in there. There's that pot of money over there. Maybe I could get at it a little bit earlier, and I wouldn't hurt myself. Or the other one, I'm not going to eat. I'm going to be able to put my money aside. Of course, you're going to eat, but we cut down on our lifestyle.
And things like the trust funds being depleted because of the pandemic. You know, the general debt that the government has built up. I don't know that I view those as imminent things that you know, somebody needs to, who's 62 now, needs to make a decision based on. But they are certainly concerns for the long term. And, you know, if I meet with a client who's in their 30s, a lot of the time we won't even put Social Security in their plan just to make sure that they're protected, even if something happens to the system.
Joe, you're good if you have people at age 30 coming in and talk to you.
That's true. Not many, but we do have the occasional. You know, this younger generation actually is a lot more engaged in investing than I know I was at that. Well, I do this for a living, but you know that my peers were, is the right way to put it, when I was in my 20s, and certainly the generation before that. I think there's a cynicism a little bit that they know they're going to have to take care of it themselves. You know, a lot of the baby boomers' parents had pensions they lived off of, and a lot of the folks in their 20s and 30s know that it's going to come down to their ability to save and invest wisely.
Okay, now I think it's time to invest wisely with a commercial. So this is an NITP commercial. So, Andrew, if you would, please.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial, transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Well, welcome back to the final leg of today's show, January 4th, 2021, first show of the year. And we have, what do we got, 15 minutes, Andrew? Andrew says 15 minutes. So we had stopped, and I have a thought here. Let me introduce tax brackets. Trust me, folks, I'm not going to talk about tax brackets pinpointed, but we're going into tax season, if you will, and probably it's the one time during the year we all look at our taxes and, gee, why do I have to pay so much, or why couldn't I put more money into the thrift and the like? And then others will look at tax brackets, and I'm not going to bore you with regards to tax brackets, but generally they start at a low of 10%, then they go to 12%. I don't think anybody listening to the show is going to be in those brackets, but then it jumps. It jumps from 10 to 12 to 22%. And people will call up and say, well, you know, this is terrible. Why couldn't I just stay in the lower bracket? And because you can't, because your income's too high. But one way to lower the taxable income, of course, is to maximize the thrift. The traditional thrift, if you do the Roth thrift, there's not going to be any tax benefit. And I'm not going to try to bore people to death with taxes. But when you look at spending money, whatever money you spend is after it's already gone through the tax machine. Tax withholding might be a certain amount that looks to be very low, but over the years it becomes very high. But when you get to a certain bracket, again, it's not hard to be in what's called a 22% federal bracket. And then if you add in the state, whether it's 5, 6, 7, or 8%, then taxes really chew up your rate of return. So you have to go to a guy like Joe and say, Joe, what can I do right? Or it's just not guys. You could go to see Karen Schaefer. Anyway, well, do you ever have that Dutch uncle talk with, you know, tax deductions are good? Well, they're not necessarily good. I remember one lady back when you could deduct interest on cars, and she and her husband came. We bought two cars, and we get this great tax deduction for the interest that we're paying on it and the sales tax that we got. And I go, ugh. And they're nice folks.
You have that issue with mortgages where people don't want to pay off their mortgage or make it go away because they're getting a tax deduction, but you're paying interest. So you're actually, you know, I mean, if you pay 4% interest and get 1% of it back, it's a 3% cost to you. So it's not, you know, tax deductions are that you pay for. I don't know that I see the benefit of. The other thing that I would say 99% of the questions I get are, what else can I do to reduce my overall tax burden? Not, you know, how can I avoid tax deductions? People certainly would want that. Is the TSP is the main way. Is maximizing what you're putting in the TSP is really the main way to reduce your overall taxes. But I have a question for you, if you don't mind, because I'm curious. I think we can talk about is one thing we ran into last year, since tax season is approaching, is people felt like they paid a lot more in taxes last year. And the reality was they paid a lot more in April when they filed, because withholding was a little different because of the tax law changes. Did you run into that? And do you see that happening in 2021?
I ran into it an awful lot, and some of it was, I mean, they were friends, but I said, this is your fault. And I go,
yeah, that's what I heard some of that too.
Yeah,
I told them to ask their CPA to run the numbers, and they found they paid the same amount of tax. The difference was in 2019, more of it was withheld. So they didn't have as big of a bill in April.
Exactly. So, you know, I'll explain it. And I use the analogy, tax brackets are somewhat like walking upstairs. The entry level that you go into any building, your house or whatever else, that's going to take you to a certain level tax-wise. But as your income goes up, you take one step up. And I find that there's a horrible misconception that if you go into a higher bracket, I've gotten these, I got a raise and it put me into a higher bracket and I lost money. Well,
right.
It's kind of numerically impossible because the additional money that you make maybe put you into a higher bracket, but that change isn't huge.
But don't you think the reason that people think that is they don't realize that the tax brackets are marginal, meaning that if the cutoff for the next bracket's 150 grand and you make 151, that 1,000 is taxed at the higher rate, not your entire 151,000. And I think that's where people get mixed up, at least in my
and
experience.
And it's a huge percentage of folks.
Yeah.
And
because obviously if you went into another bracket and all your income got taxed at a higher rate, it would make sense to not take that income. But that's not what happens.
That's true. And now that's, you know, in the work environment. Now, when the folks go into retirement, the CSRSers, there are fewer of them going. Their income is kind of set by the annuity benefit that they get. And maybe they get Social Security, maybe they don't. And they have money from the thrift. But the FERS retiree, it's not a smorgasbord, but, you know, where do I go first? Do I take money from the thrift first? Of course, I'm going to take my annuity, but then, you know, do I take Social Security now? Do I take it later? How do you work with that, Joe? It seems to me that's an algebraic equation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the first thing to know is how much of it you need. And one thing I should add I don't love is people that just sort of automatically take a withdrawal. You know, I'd rather that first year of retirement, maybe we do it for the first year, but keep reassessing it, because what you don't want to do is say your only other financial asset is your thrift and you think you're going to need $3,000 a month and you just set an automatic $3,000 a month. You want to monitor that, because if you find money accumulating in cash and savings, then you're not using it all. So you're just paying taxes ahead of time. And I think, you know, that's something that needs to be monitored. But so it's first knowing how much you need. And then, like I said earlier, I would take the money out of your savings and your taxable investments first. And I think, you know, it's funny, people are averse to that. This is one of my favorite discussions, which I'm sure other folks who are listening are thinking is, well, I have 50 grand in savings. I have $1 million in my TSP. I don't want to spend my 50,000 in savings. That's my emergency fund. That's my liquid money. Well, the day you retire, all of your money becomes your emergency fund, because the TSP is available to you if you retire at eligibility. So, you know, it's a mindset change to get people through when they retire, that now all of your money is available. It's not like when you were working and if you had an emergency, you couldn't access the TSP easily.
So what's a... People, I found, and again, I'm not in your world, they're sometimes reluctant to take anything out of the TSP because that's there for emergencies, and I worked hard to put that money in there. But with the predominance of people in FERS, there ought to be some balance between the three sources. I would guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm looking at Social Security and I'm somewhat close to the highest level, do I wait? This assuming I'm okay health-wise, as best I can tell. And then I'll bring it on when I hit a later age and I'll get more money. And again, if I'm confident in my health, then I'm going to get that higher payment for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously individual and looking at somebody's situation. I think, let me say one thing while it's on my mind, is one thing that I see people very averse to is both people are risk averse and tax averse. You know, they don't want to pay taxes and they don't want to, you know, take any risk. So if that's your mindset, what I see an awful lot of people doing is being very reluctant to take anything out of their TSP. And so they retire and they scrimp and save and try to find a way to live off the annuity, which may not be what they're used to, and that's really conservative, or they go find jobs to help pay for the difference when they don't need to. And then you have these conversations, and I've had hundreds of these, with people in their 70s that now have twice as much in the TSP as they did when they retire. And even if they wanted to spend it, they can't really think of what they would. They aren't traveling as much anymore. They don't have those desires. So I think I see a lot of the problem the other way, is that risk aversion and tax aversion keeping a lot of people from making the right decision and the right move for their particular needs. Now, that's not to say everyone should immediately retire and start spending their TSP, because people are in different financial situations. But there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle.
Well, let's say I was a new client coming in, and I'm reluctant to take anything out of any of the pots, and I'm just going to live on the annuity. Let's just say that that's impossible. What do you find then? I've got my choice now to take Social Security earlier, but I'd really like to wait to take it later. And if I take any money out of the thrift, the traditional thrift, it's going to have to pay the taxes, and I'm going to have to take more money out. So they're kind of in a quagmire. What have you found that maybe the tipping point for that individual is? Take money from the thrift first?
Yeah. I lean towards Social Security, taking Social Security as a first choice rather than taking money out of the TSP. But again, if somebody decides they want to push Social Security back to try to get a larger benefit, I can see the argument for that. But to me, if you and I are meeting and you say, I can't live off my annuity, I'm about $2,000 a month short, and your Social Security payments cover that, then why not just take the Social Security? And now you've got a set automatic income coming in that you can live off of, and your TSP will handle any overage, any of the unexpected expenses.
It's a great point. And to talk about Social Security, you don't pay tax on the full amount of Social Security anyway.
Right.
And for many states, not more than half now, there's some incentive to be living in that state because they don't tax Social Security at all, or they don't tax it as much as some other state. I don't think that should guide you where you're going to move, but certainly it's in the equation, cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a simplicity to it too, I think, of as you retire, you know, having the comfort level of a simple, easy plan. You know, sure, you could take from TSP, but then now we're increasing our tax base. We're also, you know, got to monitor that account, make sure there's enough in there to cover it. You know, I kind of like the idea of again, just as much automatic income as you can get from Social Security and from your pension. If you can live off that, then use the TSP for the extras.
Okay. And then as we utilize the TSP, do you ever get into the beneficiary side of the TSP? I mean, I assume in a marriage, it's going to go to a spouse, unless maybe both are federal employees making roughly the same money. Where does it go?
Yeah, usually the spouses designate each other, in my experience. I mean, you may have some scenario. I mean, obviously, there's all these things, prior marriages where they have, you know, separate kids or whatever. You might change it a different way. But generally, beneficiaries, you know, it would go to the spouse. The reason why is the spouse can keep the tax deferral going. So while you're working, you aren't paying any taxes on that TSP or your IRAs until you make a withdrawal. If you die and leave it to your spouse can continue that process for the rest of their life, where your kids or sister or whoever else you might leave it to cannot continue it for the rest of their life the same way.
Do you, and talking with the folks too, because I'm sure they talk to you maybe sometimes before the attorney or certainly after the attorney, because both of you have your eye on the prize, so to speak. How do we bring this plane in for a landing?
Well, the role of a CFP is kind of to, you know, we have some expertise in estate planning and tax planning and these sorts of things. And what we try to do is certainly set the table for the big picture plan. Say you may want to talk to your CPA about your withholding or about your charitable giving, and you may want to talk to your tax planner about a living trust or powers of attorney or things like that. And I can give them a cursory overview of what these things are about. But then, of course, I would tell them, rely on those professionals to give you the more direct, specific advice and, frankly, do the legwork of putting those things in place.
Yeah, I get the comments sometime, well, why can't you give me the answer?
And I said,
because I'm not an attorney. And, you know, estate, right. I understand the overall, but I don't understand every paragraph and every period and comma. And it's very important, especially when you're dealing with like a trust or the will. I would think the will is probably one of the toughest things that people have to make decisions on, especially if they have family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but again, if somebody listening has a financial planner, a CFP, a retirement investment planner, whoever, whatever their title may be that they're working with, they can be the quarterback of these things. And you can actually call them up and say, you know, should I have a living trust? And if they're a CFP, they're going to have an opinion on that to give them some education before they sit down in front of an attorney. And that's all you're really doing is just sort of setting the table so that then when they'll know the language when the time comes to really sit down with the professional.
Okay. Andrew just gave me the peace sign. In other words, we have 2 minutes. So Joe, wrap up comments. You know,
let me give you one random thing I wanted to add on the radio today is I mentioned, we talked about risk and diversification. And I think, you know, with what's happened with the pandemic and the markets, I think it's a excellent time to look at it. I mean, you can look at for instance, large company stock mutual funds that have all done quite well this year. You'll see a real variety of performance having to do with their style, the types of stocks that they invest in. The sort of traditional growth and value have performed at a very, very disparate rate. Growth did much, much better than value in 2020. So it's a good time to kind of dive a little deeper into your investments and make sure that you've got a good balance of things, that you're not betting on one category, on one sector, you're not taking too much risk. I tell you, just from experience of the folks that I've worked with on this, it gives you such peace of mind when you've analyzed that when we go through times like 2020. To know that you're balanced, your plan works, even if the market is volatile. So I think we've had the nice market recovery. I think it's a great time for people to look at that.
All right. Your timing is impeccable. Andrew just said you have 30 seconds.
Super. Well, that's not good then. I could have kept talking, Bob.
All right. Well, if you're all done, I'm all done. Andrew is a magician at bringing the plane down for a clearer landing. Joe, thank you much.
Thank you. Wishing everybody a happy 2021.
All righty. And we should do this again soon. Take good care.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WAPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.